You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
Hey, everybody. Sound like Dean Martin. Hey, everybody. This is Here District. This is a fantastic voyage. We started the voyage out, what, around February, Chris? So we're about seven months in, which is all good. And I'm the captain of this vessel, as I like to say, my first mate, Chris Johnson, my son. We are the only father and son duo, Steve Novak, to win a national championship at the same school, UCLA.
And there's no shortage of, maybe Chris isn't putting the trophies out, but I see you may have found a way to maybe put some of Chris's and yours, or maybe they're all yours behind you. That's a lot of hardware.
Yeah, and I got a couple of things of Chris back there also. But first Steve Novak played in the NBA, 11 years? I thought you played
11 years.
Yep. I thought you played longer. We'll talk a little bit about that. But 11 years, played in the NBA for 15 different teams? What was that, Steve?
24.
and our producer, Dylan Hunter Carter, not to be confused with Dylan Carter, but Dylan Hunter Carter, one of his notes was that this is what makes Steve such a great broadcaster. He played for so many different teams. So no scheme that he has not seen. He can break down with precision and perfection. But man, thank you, Steve. Outstanding broadcaster with the Milwaukee Bucks, Marquette legend, and top 10, I think eighth or ninth, you tell me, Steve, but a 3-point percentage all time. But he's the tallest guy at 6'10 to be in that group.
Arguably the sweetest shooting big man of all time from three.
Wow.
Arguably.
The sweetest
one of them.
You don't know, Marcus, but before you got on, I offered him a little bit of cash under the table. He said some real sweet things.
Oh, man.
Come to Milwaukee, I got some cash for you.
Yeah. And so that leads me into this. How did it happen? I mean, I did a little bit of a deep dive into your background. I know your dad is a coach or was a coach at Brown Deer High School where you played. He was coaching there how long before you got there? Had he been there for a while before you got there? And what role did he play? And tell us about that story in terms of the makings of Steve Novak, all-time great shooter.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is for sure for me where I start. Where it all starts is my dad was a high school basketball coach. He was coaching at Brown Deer High School. Basically, the year I was born, he took the Brown Deer High School job. So he was there long before he ended up coaching me at Brown Deer High School. But I think that just paints the picture of, okay, well, how did you grow up, Steve? And it was like, well, my dad was a basketball coach. He was a football coach, a baseball coach. He taught a bunch of classes, typing and business ed and gym class and everything. So, you know, my earliest memories are growing up with my dad in the gym at his practices. And, you know, sometimes it was just running around in the hallways acting goofy. But I think, you know, for me, when I think back to, okay, they say, you know, where did your basketball journey begin? You know, it was before I, you know, had any memories. It was simply me with my pops hanging out, getting candy out of the vending machine and him bringing me along. And I think, you know, there's so many, I think, players that make it to the highest level, that have success at the highest level, that, you know, we like to say, oh, you know, I've spent more time and I worked harder and I did all these things. And, oh, sure, I mean, I put some work in. But there's no doubt it starts for me with my pops. And I think just creating the environment where I love to be with him. I love to be shooting. I love the sound of the basketball. I love the squeak of the shoes. His high school players were my absolute heroes at Brown Deer High School. Those are the guys I wanted to be. And then I think that, to be honest, that just fed me to be obsessive and to get my repetitions and to want to, you know, be better than those guys. And so, you know, looking back now, like you said, playing 11 years in the NBA, you go, man, I play with some awesome guys. I did some cool things, but at the end of the day, I'm grateful that I grew up in that environment where it was like, you can come shoot, you can come eat some licorice off the floor and call it gym time. But I was with my pops just hanging out at Brown Deer, and that's where it started for me.
So, Steve, so a quick story for me. My dad, Jeff Johnson, was a great high school coach down in Louisiana Central, Natchitoches Central High School, same school that Joe Dumars went to years later. My dad actually coached his principal, I think. I wound up speaking at Joe's high school banquet his senior year. And so, but when he was at Natchitoches Central in the late 50s, I was 3 years old. Now, I don't remember any of this, vaguely some of it, but my mother told me he would sit me on the bench beside him for the whole game, home and away. I'd sit, I had a spot on the bench, and every time out, every halftime, every quarter break, I'd take a ball and I'd demand to dibble. Couldn't say dribble, but dibble up and down the floor. And I'd dribble up and down the floor. I'd dibble up and down the floor, and the fans would just go crazy, you know, because I didn't lose the ball. I'm going up and down. But it just reminded me, and I'm sure Chris has some stories. Well, I hope Chris has some stories like that. But just the love that our dads infused in us for this great game of basketball. And so for me, it wasn't like work, getting out there working out. It was just, man, it was play. It was fun. It was good times. You couldn't pull me off the court, man. I just love the game. And I give my dad a lot of credit for infusing me with a lot of that love with the game of basketball. It sounds like, you know, you went through the same thing.
Yeah, I did. I see Chris shaking his head. He's going, yeah, I got some memories too. But no, I, to your point, and not to rabbit hole or to tangent, but I think to your point, like, look who you became. And you wonder why was Marcus so special? You know, why was I able to shoot the ball as a 6'10 guy? What was it? You know, if you go back, like, turn it into a Malcolm Gladwell book and you start to go, like, where were you born? When were you born? Who raised you? What were your environment? What were all those things? I think it's always interesting, the similarities, you know, that there's that overlap. Not all stories are the same, but like you said, a lot of times your pop's taking your hand and creating an environment. And I think like you do, like Chris does, I know we were chatting about the time he spends in the gym now working, you know, a ton of different people out, including, you know, your daughter. And so it's to me the same I want to do for my kids, is create that environment, because then all of a sudden one day you get to look back and go, like, hey, they, like you said, they loved it. They created it, just an awesome basketball community. And so I'm thankful for that. And I do think, like you said, that the overlapping similarities with the background like that, it just has so much to do with it.
Well, now, so Chris was playing at the Barrington Rec Center. He's probably 8-9 years old, Steve. He hadn't scored a bucket in 2 or 3 games. I'm traveling back and forth. 8 years old, that'd have been, 1983. So I'm with the Milwaukee Bucks at that time. So I'm on the road a lot. And so every time I talk to him, you know, how many buckets you get? None. You know, it's okay. All right, no problem. Just keep working hard. So one day the thought occurred to me, you know, give him some incentives. I said, look, every bucket you score, I'm going to give you $10. So he played a game that next Saturday, and he came to me all smiles like, Dad, you owe me $120. he scored like 12 buckets. So I saw what the key was to unlocking it, locking his motivation, and that kind of got him started off being bucket-minded. But, yeah,
Chris, you dangled the carrot, man.
Yeah. But, Steve, you got a son. Yeah. How old is Mac now?
I have two sons. I have a 14-year-old son, Mac, and then a 7-year-old son, Press. And then I got a daughter squeezed there in the middle. That's an 11-year-old. They all enjoy hoop. My 7-year-old, he's a rug rat. He's running around. I don't know what he's starting fires in the backyard more than he's playing basketball. But my 14-year-old loves it. He's me and my wife are fighting some nights. My son is saying, Dad, take me to the gym right now. I want to go get on the gun, the rebounding machine, and get some shots up. And I say, okay. And my wife says, we have to have dinner as a family. I said, well, he said he wanted to go shoot. So, yeah, we're working through it.
Yeah, and you're coaching his teams. You were coaching his teams. I mean, how's that been for you? I mean, is that how long you plan to keep trying to do that? I mean, at some point, just word of advice, you're going to have to kind of pull away a bit at some point. Maybe not, depending on your approach and how well you guys kind of get along on the floor. But how's that been for you? Because it's, you know, we've got some stories between Chris and I. But it was a big turning point, I think, in his career when I took over. Because it's like, yeah, shoot any shot you want to get. Go out there and get some buckets.
Yeah, it's true. You know, like you talked about, the way your experience was with your pops and mine with me was, my dad was a high school coach. So he didn't coach me all the way until I got to be in high school. And so I think the roles are a little bit flipped. You know, for me, I'm coaching my little man pretty much from as soon as he starts dribbling the ball. You know, I anticipate through eighth grade, which is this season for him, will probably be the last year I coach him. And then I hand him off to someone. And, you know, to your point, I think I recognize that. I think the greatest value in that is I'm able to create that environment still, like my pops did for me. Make it a positive environment, work on the things I think are important. But at the end of the day, create something that you love, that you enjoy. Not this overly stringent, if you don't blitz the pick and roll right, if you don't do all the footwork correct, just like a great environment. And so I enjoy you know, coaching them. I enjoy being with them in the gym, to your point, because I realize I'm going to be handing them off and someone else gets to critique him and decide, I think, how to use him. But more than anything, I think, you know, the empowerment that I feel like as his dad, I'm able to give him in those environments is fun for me. But I just know, looking back, I'm never going to say, oh, I coached him too much, or I was with him too long when he was young, that kind of thing. So I think I do. I try to mimic what my dad was to me. And I think little roles reverse, but these years are special. And like you said, I'm sure you and Chris have a lot of those years. You were probably still playing and Chris was getting jump shots up. So it's just a special thing. And I think it has so much to do with every guy's basketball journey, who they're looking up to and who's bringing them along.
And Steve, last thing on this point. So me and my dad coming along, it was a different era. He had a different style as far as, you know, development and how he taught. You know, a lot of it was physicality, one-on-one, not taking it easy. I'm sure that you and your pops had a relationship on the court too, that, you know, it wasn't always rosy, but I'm sure you guys figured things out. Now, when times kind of get a little tough with you and your kids now, and I'm sure, you know, everybody goes through a little bit of adversity. How do you handle it? How do you deal with it? Like, what type of approach do you take that might differ from the way that you and your pops kind of dealt with things?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because a lot of people ask me, hey, you coach your son, you know, boy, that's got to be challenging. You know, how does that work? Or people say, like, hey, you played for your dad. Oh, that had to be challenging. How was that? And to be honest, you know, for me playing for my dad, it really wasn't. And like you said, it had so much to do, I think, with his style and who he was. He was one of those guys that wasn't really hard on you. He wanted to get the most out of you. But I think he, more than anything, looked at every win you got as a learning experience and every loss you got as a learning experience. And to his credit, in the same way, I think I was able to become the shooter that I was. I like to say that I still am. There's the shooter that I was, because he took the same approach. It wasn't, you're bigger than everyone, you're taller, you have to have your back to the basket. He kind of, I think, let me lead. Hey, you want to go to the gym and shoot? Hey, here's the code to the gym. Hey, you want to be a big fella who steps out and shoots it? If that's what you love, go right ahead and do it. He wasn't, this is how it is and I'm going to show you and you're wrong. He would make sure to have those moments like Hoosiers, where he would draw the circle on the basketball, put the dot, and then say, this is what you know, the dot, and this is what I know, the circle, when I got too smart for him. But I'm grateful for his style, which was very accepting of, who do you want to be? What do you enjoy doing? And so when people say, like, hey, how did you become the shooter that you became? What was the style of play? Long before three-point shooting was even considered really acceptable or not settling, why were you doing that at that size? And it was because he said, if that's what you enjoy, I want you to do that. And so I really got that strict coaching, that system coaching, once I got to college. But up to that point, it really was about the love and the enjoyment and the style that was a good time. I think he leaned into that. If this is how you want to play, like, let's figure out some sets. Let's figure out the personnel. Let's figure out how to make it a really good time. And I just think it's something that gets a little lost in youth hoops nowadays. And I'm just so grateful, looking back, that it really was about skill development, the repetitions, the time spent in the gym. But more than anything, it wasn't about, you know, being perfect. It was about, if this is the style and the enjoyment that you guys like in basketball, that's what we're going to do. And so we had a great relationship. And my son and I think I just mimic my dad's style very much, where, like you said, Marcus, I just tell him, let it fly. There's not a shot that he sees that I don't like. And he hasn't argued with me about that. So far, so good.
Yeah, I can remember my son Josiah. I was coaching him at the Westwood Rec, Chris, and he's about 9 years old. He comes by the bench, and he's like, got the ball in his hands, dribbling with his left hand. He's like, Dad, it's like, what? He's like, can I shoot a three? Yeah, go ahead. He pulled it right in front of me, swished it, you know, went on, kind of strutted down the floor. But just those moments, man. And speaking of shooting threes, man, you know, a generation before you, they would have had you inside and playing with your back to the basket at 6'10". Were there guys out there that were your models? I won't say role models, but guys that you modeled your game, bigs that shot the ball that you felt like you wanted to play like growing up?
You know, to be honest, not bigs. There weren't bigs. And I say that to say, like, I didn't really ever consider myself a big. You know, I was 6'10", but I was certainly a small forward.
Right.
I wasn't down there wrestling with guys. And so I didn't identify my game with, you know, the big fellas that were out there. I looked at, to be honest, it was my dad's high school players. It was the three-point shooters, the guys that were, you know, before we really understood the analytics or even knew what analytics was, I was like, those guys are winning games. Those guys are exciting to watch. Those guys are moving the needle. And so, and thankfully for me, it was also growing up in Milwaukee, it was Ray Allen and it was Michael Redd. Those were the guys that I watched the way, you know, Ray and Mike, they moved off of screens and they got their shots off and they were unapologetic at a time when you were like 3-point shooting and you could listen to everybody go on about how bad it was and how, you know, you lose shooting those shots. I just loved watching the way that they just ran off those screens and let that thing fly. And so that was what I mimicked. That's what I wanted to be.
A Big Dog Robinson, he was the guy that was around. You grew up watching him at that right the same time. I mean, he's a big 6'8", 6'9", just 6'7", 6'8", I think. But just perimeter-oriented, sweet shooting, handle. You know, guys like that are always interesting to me because they're not that they're before their times, but they play a different style of game. A Glenn Rice at 6'8", to be able to do some of the things he did. Those are guys that I really, really, really look at it and feel like that they were ahead of the game at that point in their careers.
Yeah, they were. No, they really were. And I think, you know, to your point, a generation back, you look at it and you go, man, oh, man, how, you know, they were barely shooting any threes. And then I look at the generation where I was playing in the NBA and I was drafted by Daryl Morey, who was in his first year kind of under Carol Dawson. Rest in peace. He recently just passed. And so I'm so thankful that I was right on the cusp of the first year of Daryl Morey being a GM. I was picked by the analytics guru who said, hey, I think he can help us. And how grateful am I to just say, like, it was recognized. They understood kind of what I was doing and how I could help a team win. Because just a few years before that, Daryl Morey wasn't in the league. Sam Hinkie wasn't in the league. The analytics, they weren't there. So I hit it right at that time where I think they went, hey, this is useful. This is helpful. And so, you know, I think I came into a time where we did get to what we thought was let it fly. Now we look back, you know, 10 years and we go, no, we weren't even scratching the surface. But I'm thankful that at least we got to, I think, get some respect and some recognition for what that skill brought and brings, you know, to winning basketball games.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
Steve, quick question about your time in Houston. You guys won 22 straight. One point, I was curious, like I've seen some of those winning streaks across NBA history. How does an NBA team win 20 straight games? What's it like in the locker room? What was your level of lock in as a team? Like, just talk to me about that streak and how it went down.
Oh, man, that was a special streak, man. And that was a special team. When I think about, you know, how guys come into the NBA. So think about this. I get drafted by the Houston Rockets. Daryl Morey is the GM. Jeff Van Gundy is the coach. Tom Thibodeau is an assistant coach. Steve Clifford is an assistant coach. Andy Greer, who's been with Coach Thibodeau for forever. My veterans are Yao Ming, Tracy McGrady, Juwan Howard, Dikembe Mutombo, Shane Battier. And so, like, yes, I mean, sir. You know, that's the short answer. You know, think about those people. Those, I mean, that not necessarily players, but those people. Dikembe took me shopping. He said, "Rookie, you come with me." I promise. He was picking out suits at the men's warehouse. He said, "This brown one, you need this gray one." He said, "One blue one." I promise. He bought me my first suits. He pushed the cart right along with me.
He paid for them. He can be
legend.
Paid
now he brought them to the counter. There was like a Kings of Comedy, a Kings of Comedy set where it was some DVDs. He said, "And I need this." And he put the Kings of Comedy DVD in the cart. And then he said, "Go ahead. Now you pay for it. Go ahead."
Not today.
Jimmy, how happy are folks who save hundreds of dollars switching to Geico?
Happier than Dikembe Mutombo blocking a shot.
So it was just, I say that to say it was a special group. You know, you had Shane Battier, the ultimate glue guy. You had a system with Jeff Van Gundy that was going to be consistent every night. Everybody was accountable. Everybody knew what they were supposed to be doing. There was no vagueness. So when you think about winning that many games in a row, you know, it's all those guys and it's the system. And we were veteran and we were a damn good team.
After the ball went out of bounds, here we go. Rafer will bring it in the out. Now looking to McGrady. McGrady picked up by Artest. It's one-on-one right now. McGrady lost the ball, gets it back. 6 seconds left. It's on Novak. Steve Novak with his only basket of the game.
And it was, I've been a part of two teams where there were like magical runs like that. You know, if I take college out of it, it was in Houston winning those 22 games. And you look around and then you look back and you go, those are some special dudes at a special time playing some really good ball. And then, you know, my time in New York with Linsanity, where you look back and you look around and you go like, man, that was, I almost can't even put into words how it happened, but it was, you know, religious and magical and a lot of things. But, you know, you're grateful when it goes right, because, you know, it's never guaranteed.
Fans on their feet. 5-4. Win for the win. Got it.
Well, and Chris, this is the cold thing. So when we're making it after schedule, Steve and I kind of split up the games and try and be accommodating to each other in terms of, you know, family vacations or whatever's going on, Shiloh's sure, basketball sure. games, Max games.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Steve came to me a couple of years ago and said, you know, I'd like to get as many New York Knicks games in New York as possible. And, you know, I'm 60s. I'm past the point of, you know, loving New York like that. So it was fine with me. Sure. But his reception in New York is still amazing. But the most amazing
Knicks royalty.
Steve, well, it's not like you played there 6 or 7 or 8. You played there, what, 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years.
How does that happen? How do you become so beloved in a city like New York in just 2 short years? What's the dynamics behind that?
Well, again, the short answer is we won. And, I think you've been on teams. You know what it feels like when you win, what the fans feel like when you win. The teams you win with, you still text with, you still talk to. There's something about that. The fans that you won in front of, they still want to see you. They still want to talk about it. So we won, you know, and I was there 11-12, 12-13. 11-12 was Linsanity. We came out of the lockout. The team hadn't been above 500 in a decade. You kind of think like, all right, 2 preseason games and we're going to throw these guys out there. And then, I mean, you know, we'll kind of see what this season looks like. You know, we won 36 games that year. Now, that was a shortened season where it was only 72 games. Or no, that was 66 games.
Yeah, 66 games. Yeah.
So, you know, so we were, 55%, you know, win percentage. And then you add Linsanity into it, and it was magic. But I would say, you know, the last time that the New York Knicks won as many games as we won in that 11-12 season when I was with the Knicks was 1997. Even last year, they had 50 wins. We had 54 wins. And so I think one, winning, it makes it so much more special. But obviously, you think about the personnel. You got the Carmelo Anthonys, the Amari Stoudemires, what Jeremy Lin did. I think that was just so special. But what really made it happen, I think, was how many unselfish guys we had on that team that don't get enough credit for what that was. You think about J.R. Smith. Yes, he's an unbelievable scorer and shooter, but he's one of the best passers I ever played with. And he was unapologetic about anything. He was going to let it fly. New York loved that style. You think about Mike D'Antoni as the coach. He said, if you score more points than your opponents, you're going to win. And we're looking like, does he think we're stupid? But he meant it. He's like, Steve, if you score more points than your guy, you get to stay in. If you don't, you got to come out. And you're like, I'm sorry. Like, this is just too simple for me. But you got guys like Tyson Chandler, unselfish. Landry Fields, unselfish. Mike Bibby and Jason Kidd were on those teams that second year. And I just think about all the things those guys that didn't get as much notice and credit did to make that all happen. And, you know, it was magic.
So let's not skip over the Marquette years. So just go briefly touch on that. You went to the Final Four. I was there. What was that? New Orleans as a freshman. That was Carmelo was there. Syracuse. Yeah, that was a heck of a Final Four. But was there any other schools that you were seriously considering? Was Wisconsin even a thought at that time? Or how does that work out for Steve Novak around that time, 2002, Gatorade State Player of the Year, Wisconsin? When Marquette comes a calling, what was your mindset then?
Look, I grew up with my dad. He would say, hey, look, we're playing hooky. It's the state tournament. And he would pull me out of school, my little brother, my sister. We got to ditch school for the week when it was the high school state tournament. And that was always at Madison in Wisconsin. And so for me, I had this affiliation with the University of Madison that it was beloved. It was kind of this sacred place that I got to skip school and go with my pops. So I truly, I had a love for University of Wisconsin. But at the time when I was being recruited, it was Dick Bennett, and he was already, we knew he was leaving. So he recruited me. I visited. It was him. Tony was there. And then basically I knew he was leaving. So you were kind of waiting to see who was the next head coach. It was Soderbergh for like an interim year. And then Bo Ryan took over, and kind of like throughout that process, although I was all open ears to Madison, I was kind of going through it with Bill Self at Illinois and Billy Donovan at Florida and Tom Crean, obviously, at Marquette. And so I was so far down the path of, you know, who loves me, who believes in me, who wants me, where can I be? And I hadn't even been able to kind of go to Wisconsin in my mind, what they could be as a fit. And at the end of the day, I had some awesome offers, the ones I just mentioned. But, you know, Tom Crean, I just knew was my mom. She told me, you're going to Marquette. I love Tom Crean. I think he's going to develop you. I think he's going to graduate you. I think he's going to put you around winners and good guys. And, you know, looking back, I'm so thankful that my mom is smarter than me and was right.
I left to my own devices. I don't wound up at UC Santa Barbara. So they got my parents. My parents made me sign that letter of intent, and then they mailed it right away before I took a trip to UCSB because they didn't want nothing to happen. But go ahead, Chris.
As a UCLA guy, like when we look at Marquette and other programs around the country, there's sort of this fascination. Like I was always fascinated with Marquette because it was in Milwaukee and the success and just the style of play and the type of guys that came out of that program. Steve, break down for me. Like, what is a Marquette guy like, and what does that act mean in sense of basketball and then outside of basketball?
You know, you're right. I hear that term a lot. You know, he's a Marquette guy. And I've thought about that sometimes. Like, what does that mean exactly? Because I feel like there's quite an array of guys that have come out of Marquette, you know, at least in the recent era. I think about kind of back to my time. It was, you know, Travis Diener. There was myself, you know, D. Wade, pretty special. But then you look at a little more recent, you get like the Jay Crowders, the Wes Matthews, even the Jamal Canes, you know, who have come onto the scene now. And Tyler Kolick is now. Let's not leave out Jimmy Butler. But, you know, I do. I think that there's like this. And when I think about Marquette, I think it's NBA ready. You know, I think there's a certain level of toughness that I think has kind of been able to translate from, you know, the Tom Crean era to the Buzz Williams era, you know, to the Shaka era, where guys that come out, whether it's, you know, Tyler Kolick and Oso and Omax, they seem NBA ready, and they have been stars and have been proven, I think, that they can score the ball, they can be elite at something. But I think that all those, every guy I mentioned, honestly, even including D. Wade, They play their role in the NBA. And when I say D. Wade, he's a Hall of Famer. But you think about who he played with. You know, he played with LeBron. He played with Shaq. And even then, he was able to play his role. And I think about, you know, Jimmy Butler. He's maybe not the most role player guy in that whole list. I'd say he's pretty alpha. But of all those other guys, I just think, you know, Travis Diener, Tyler Kolick, Jay Crowder, Wes Matthews is the perfect example where he's a stud. But he fits such a special role. So I think that's what a Marquette guy is. They're NBA ready, and they play those roles of those 400 out of, you know, the 450 guys.
We talked about this with David Aldridge on the last podcast, but just a couple of things. Who would be your Mount Rushmore of Wisconsin ball players? Either a guy that went to high school, I'm not going to limit to that, or played college in Wisconsin. And then what if Wisconsin has a style that kind of embodies what Wisconsin ballers are all about. Chicago, they've got their own brand of just, you know, flash and great point guards. New York, obviously. D.C., David Aldridge talked about efficiency. L.A., we're kind of also more fundamentally sound, not a lot of flash. When you think about the Kawhi Leonard and Paul Pierce and guys like that coming out of L.A. Wisconsin, what's the style? And then give me your Mount Rushmore, your top four. You can put yourself on there if you want to, but just the top four Wisconsin ballers of all time.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's, you know, I feel like when I think about that list of the Wisconsin guys, and depending on how far you look back, it's hard to, you know, pick a certain style. But I would say the guys that come to my mind, you know, I feel like an underdog, an underrated ness to the guys that come out of Wisconsin. I feel like I'm speaking to like the Tyrese Halliburtons, the Wes Matthews, the maybe the Sam Hausers even, but yeah, the Brandon Pazinskis, you know,
facts, at Golden State facts. Now.
Yeah, like all you go like, damn, like they're really contributing. They're really, and I mean, Halliburton's doing more than contributing. He's winning gold medals. But if I was to put a category on it, I would say underrated and then overachieving. But as far as my Mount Rushmore, man, there's some. So when I was in high school, I'll start with this. I'm going to the bank to get my birth certificate notarized or something for my, I remember I was about to drive. So I'm at the bank at Pick and Save and Brown Deer. And there's a big body black tinted out, murdered out Mercedes. I said, wow, that's nice. I'm trying to have one. And then the window rolls down as I'm walking into the bank to get this birth certificate notarized. And it's Sprewell. There he is. I said, excuse me, Mr. Sprewell, would you mind? So he signed my birth certificate because that's he wasn't a notary.
Wow. He signed your birth certificate? That's sick.
So, I mean, he was at that time, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So he's got to be up there. I mean, one of the great. I think Nick Van Exel is on there. I think Caron Butler is on there.
Wow.
You know, this is for me. I think, you know, my era, you know, for my pops, he would always talk about guys like Joe Wolf, you know,
yes, the color kid. Yes.
Yeah. So I think that might be my Mount Rushmore. You know,
who was the last one I talked over? Who was the last one? You said Joe Wolf, and who was the final one?
No, Joe. I was saying Joe Wolf, Caron. I think maybe Sprewell, Van Exel. I think those guys, you know, are the ones in my mind that when I think about, like, who did I watch? Who did I couldn't believe that they were, you know, in my presence or lived near me or came from where I came from? I'm like, man, if I could ever be anywhere near their level, I'll have made it. Those are the guys that I think of from Wisconsin. But obviously, I mean, now we got a whole new era. That's, you know, the Halliburtons, the Wes Matthews, you know, those guys.
It was a revelation to me when you were talking about underdogs that overachieved. And when I got here in 1977, I mean, Milwaukee had almost like this identity crisis of being like a smaller market team, yeah. The smallest arena, just under 11,000 seats at the Mecca back in the day. But the fans, man, they appreciated just effort, energy, commitment. Just and if you fell short and you lose to Dr. J and the Sixers and Moses Malone, so be it. You lose to Larry Bird and Robert Parrish and those great Boston Celtics team. You know, it wasn't like they held it against you. Just, man, you guys did as best that you could. And that seems to be a driving force behind that whole underdog thing. It's like guys here just in Wisconsin just have an understanding of just putting forth that effort and let the chips kind of fall where they may.
You know, you and I have both played in places where that's not the case. Yeah. There's not a if, you know, you go hard and you leave it out there, it's enough. And so I think Milwaukee does not get enough credit for the special sports town that it is. And, you know, for the reasons you just described that I don't think I have to repeat, but you know, also overall, like you just think about even just, you know, I got my Packers helmet sitting here. To be able to have a Giannis, you know, to your point, and to be able to have a championship in the last few years and to have a Dame Lillard here now, you think back to when, we won't say names, but when there were guys drafted by the Milwaukee Bucks, and because of the town that it was thought of at the time, said, no, thank you. Like, I'm not coming there. And now guys are coming here. And so I do think that you know, so much has happened in the last, you know, decade as far as the change in ownership and the new arena and the Giannis effect to everything. It is, it's a special time, you know, to be a Bucks fan and to live in Milwaukee, to live in Wisconsin, because we, you know, our Brewers are doing a damn good job. Our Packers are doing a damn good job. And boy, oh boy, Giannis, having him here, I just think about my kids, and I think they got no idea. They have no idea how cool it is to be here right now cheering for this team. And so, you know, I know it's why you do it. It's why I do it, to allow my family to be around an environment and around people, specifically the players and people like you that are in basketball at this level. And you're thankful when they also happen to be, you know, incredible role models. And so I think we're in that era where all those things are true.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
What is it like to be a teammate of Giannis's? I mean, I know what it's like to just work with him, be a broadcaster. I'm not saying we're friends. We're cool. We're good. But yeah. You're an actual teammate, and that's a whole different level of interaction. What was it like to be a teammate of Giannis when you're here in Milwaukee?
No, you're right. You know, I'm not in the locker room with him every day either anymore. But to your point, I do very vividly remember being at the Cousins Center with the Giannis Antetokounmpo that I was teammates with for two seasons. And that was right when he was in the most improved, winning that award. And I've been able to have the privilege of watching him now, I think, to where he's gotten and to be close enough to just see the difference in he was learning. He was young. He was improving. He was becoming, you know, I think a Hall of Fame player right before our eyes. But I think now, I think to look at who he is to the level of consistency that he's been able to play at, the level of dominance that he's been able to play at, I think the focus that he has, you've played with enough guys, Marcus, and Chris, I'm sure you've been around enough guys to know superstars aren't always like Giannis. I mean, this guy is, he doesn't have balance in his life in a good way. Yes, he spends time with his family, but he wants to be the greatest player to ever play basketball. And whether that happens, whether he's ever known as that, we'll see. He's still writing that book, but you just have to love as a fan of Giannis. That's what I've been able to see is I was his teammate as most improved. He's so far beyond, let me try to win an MVP. He's so clearly saying, how can I leave a legacy of being the greatest player of all time? And I know a lot of people who haven't played at the highest level go, that's delusional. He'll never be that, or that person will never be that. Giannis believes it. And obviously, I think he's done things that show that he can certainly be in that conversation if his trajectory, you know, continues, because it hasn't stopped.
Did you think Giannis would evolve into a two-time MVP? Like when he was most improved, what were your thoughts? Did you think two-time MVP and NBA champion at that time, Steve?
Yeah. When I was, you know, I think back to, you know, my first experiences with D-Wade. You know, and I think about the first time I played with D-Wade at the old gym at Marquette. And I mean, literally the first time. And I thought to myself, wow, he's good. But I'm a high school kid at that time who's coming and playing with the Marquette guys, Cordell Henry, Brian Wardle. So I don't have the perspective of what a Hall of Fame guy or what a great looks like. I'm not Jerry West. I'm not Pat Riley. I haven't seen these kind of guys before. So I see D-Wade and I think, wow, he's special. Like he can really be good, maybe play in the NBA. And I think back now and I laugh at that and I go, like, play in the NBA. That's what I thought. He could maybe play in the NBA. Guy's one of the greatest of all time. And I have to admittedly say the same about Giannis. Having played in the NBA, been around really good players, having played with Giannis in those years where he was most improved, I was like, wow, look at his skill set. Look at his size. Look at his wingspan. He could really be a special player. But, you know, naively, I guess I would say I never thought D-Wade would ever be as good as he became. I just never imagined it. And with Giannis, I never imagined I never thought someone could score 30 points a game and shoot, 60% from the field per game, where, you know, I was a role player where it was for me to score in double figures, you know, five straight games. I was like, wow, I'm really doing it. And then you got a guy like Giannis doing it at a level that I think you almost have to be one of them. You have to be a Hall of Fame. You have to be a Marcus Johnson to understand. And I mean that, to know what that feels like on a daily basis, what those pressures are, what it really means to be that consistent and that good. And so I just, you know, I was a good player. I played in the NBA. I'm one of whatever, 4,500 players in the history of the world. But then there's that echelon that Giannis is in that he continues to shock me. And I hope he continues to, you know, continues to do just that.
So a couple of things. It leads me to the comments by Charles Barkley about Giannis. And my thing is this, Steve. I mean, this is what, his 10th year, whatever it is. I don't know the number. He'll be 30 years old this year. So it's maybe a little more than 10. But coming off the 30-point, 12 rebounds, 60% field goal percentage year last year, nobody's ever done that. I mean, you think about all the bigs, Kareem and Wilt and all these guys that you would think would Shaq would be able to match those numbers. Nobody's ever done that. But there's always the I won't call it nitpicking, but the criticism that he needs to improve his game. I don't know. I mean, to me, it's like Popeye. I am what I am. You know, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you how I'm going to do it, and then I'm going to do it. I'm getting to the basket, and I'm going to try and dunk or score. You know what I mean? It's like Giannis kind of is. If he could sprinkle in a couple of mid-rangers, I saw some of that in the Olympics over the summer. We always talk about he's worked on his jump shot, and his jump shots, you know, What's your take on a comment like Charles Barkley makes, or other people make their observations about Giannis's game? And do you think he's got how much room for improvement? How much of a ceiling left is there for Giannis at this stage of the game?
Yeah, it's a boy. For a lot of people, it's a pretty easy answer. I feel like you go like, well, it's probably this, and this is why I know that. You know, to be honest with Giannis, for two reasons. One, he's shown over his career, like you said, that when you thought he was averaging 23, you were like, wow, he's probably about, you know, he's about maxed out. And then he was 25, and then it was 27, then it was 29, then it was 30-ish for, you know. Yeah. And then the rebounds went up. And then the field goal percentage continues, like you said, last year to climb. And I just don't think that can be taken lightly because, you know, I just want to give a little perspective. For a guy who's played in the NBA for 11 years on 9 teams, you know, you stay in all the hotels. You fly, you travel on all the flights. You see all the distractions. But not all the distractions that a guy like Giannis, who has a shoe deal and has an airline deal and has a headphone deal and has all these people that are all over. So I say that to say, for a guy like him to be able to focus, when there are people pulling at him and leaning on him that are paying him millions and millions of dollars, it's remarkable. And that's why, like you, when you said, you know, guys like Shaq haven't done it, Wilt haven't done it. It is remarkable that he has that level of focus, of that level of drive. I think you just see the ability to be distracted. And so to your point, I think to some degree, you have to go, how much more can he do? How responsible is Giannis for the guys around him? How much more can he really develop as far as when you say shooting, speaking as a shooter? I will tell you, one of my greatest advantages, my greatest strengths was my greatest weakness, which was I was not the most athletic guy. And so I had, from a very early age, I had the wisdom, the recognition, thank God, if you want to make it at the highest, I thought at the varsity level, and then I dreamed of playing in college and dreamed of playing in the NBA. If you want to really make it at that level, you're not more athletic than these guys. You're not going to be able to do the things you want to do. You better be able to shoot it. So in eighth grade, I started shooting it like my life depended on it because it did. Giannis will never be burdened with that extreme. He can still get away with dunking on guys and slashing and running in transition, whereas I would get 0 points and he will get all the points still doing that. And so I think that desperation is what will keep Giannis from being a great shooter, not his fault. He doesn't need it to be successful and to be who he is. So I think you just can't ask him to do that. And you can't ask him, I think, to be responsible for the role players and what they do and how they play. That's for Doc. That was for Bud. That was for J. Kidd to adjust and to concoct. But I'm a big opposer to adjust. If you're a bad team, you need to adjust. If you're a team like the Bucks have been in recent years, I'm very much on the side of you make teams play to who you are, which is Giannis getting 30 scoring, 60% rebounding that thing just about every other possession. And I know there's a fine line to adjustments in game and all that, but I just am never going to believe that Giannis needs to adjust to his team. I think his team needs to adjust to him. And I don't think Giannis's teams need to adjust to who they're playing. I think teams should have to adjust to him. And then, of course, it's up to him to make the right play, you know, and be unselfish. But you know, that's
and he's doing that. He's doing that. His passing. Yes, his passing. Yes. Look at his passing the last 5 or 6 years. How much that's improved.
I mean, yes.
And the angles that he's able to deliver.
That left hand pass he throws.
Across the body, going full speed this way, left hand blind corner, right in the pocket of the shooter.
Crazy.
He didn't get the credit for the improvement in areas that have made the game easier. I'm not always one to say you can make guys better, but you can make the game easier for guys on your team, and I think Giannis has done that. Steve, Giannis and Dame Lillard, the pick and roll, you know, that's something that people thought would be just this devastating weapon, and it still might be. It just put your coach's hat on. You've played for 11 teams, 9 teams, 11 years, different coaches, different schemes, different approaches. What do you see with the pick and roll? What's going to be the key for this to be more successful than it was last year?
Boy, I'll tell you. First of all, you, me, and Chris combined don't make enough to be solving all these problems. So I'm not going to come out and say that I have the answer. But to your point, you know, just watching closely and rewatching the film and kind of watching those two play together and watching specifically their pick and roll possessions. When you look back at the film, you know, I do think I'm of the philosophy again that a pick and roll is not two players. And I think we talk about it a lot of times, like Dame handles it and Giannis sets it. You know, why is Dame or Giannis not scoring the ball? I think that it often comes down to the system that the coach puts out there, the chemistry and the familiarity that guys have, those two, as well as the other three guys out there on the court. And then I think also the skill sets of those other three guys and their understanding of what are we trying to accomplish in this individual pick and roll set.
Bucks going the other way now. Giannis into the front court. Backs it out. Lillard steps into the three, and he drills it from straight on. Giannis sets up Dame. He was played well by Brook Lopez on that occasion as Lillard's going the other direction. Drives around Batum. Lobs up top to Giannis, who staples it down on the dunk with a foul. Oh, the Greek Freak set up marvelously by Damian Lillard delivering the dime.
So I do think we're too hard on those two because obviously, you know, NBA defenses are when they go, we're playing the Milwaukee Bucks. One thing they're going to do in shoot around is scheme for Giannis and Dame in the pick and roll. They're going to have that part figured out. And so it's on the other guys as much as it is them, in my opinion, to not necessarily score the ball, but to be threats to score the ball. And if they do, then I think teams call a timeout. They adjust. Hey, we got to take Gary Trent Jr. away. We got to take this guy. We got to take this guy away because they're making shots. And then Dame and Giannis get to go to work. And so I think it's so many things, but I would guess I would say I just think Dame and Giannis, I think, need to know and have guys out there on the floor that they trust and that they want to score primarily. Because if those other guys are featured and they're threats at 40% from three-point range, then the pick and roll, it naturally opens itself up, or the pick and roll gets the credit for those other three guys scoring the ball. And I think there needs to be patience. Like in the pick and roll, when Dame comes off and he hits Giannis, it might not be Giannis for a dunk. It might be Giannis to the corner and they swing the ball top. Then they find Giannis again. And so I just think it's like it's always so much more than just a simple pick and roll action that I think we kind of talk about on a low level. I think these are two of the greatest players with two of the highest levels of skill scoring interior and perimeter. And so to me, it's so heavily based on being so creative and such a good coach and Doc, you know, cracking some of those codes. Who do we put and where? And for those other three guys to make shots and to be threats, because then I think it you know, that along with the chemistry of Giannis and Dame, meaning their love for one another, their true love and care for one another to help each other as friends, I think is what makes basketball, is what makes pick and roll, is what makes, once you create an advantage for someone, who is the guy that actually scores the ball, I think is what makes that happen.
Yeah, you made some great points about just the dynamics of the pick and roll surrounding the guys with the type of shooters that can create the type of space that's needed. Let me get your thoughts on the Bucks offseason acquisitions, Gary Trent Jr., DeLon Wright, Torian Prince. I mean, these are all 36 or better percent three-point shooters, guys that can do a lot of things on both sides of the basketball. Just break down some thoughts on the Bucks free agent acquisitions.
Yeah, you know, like you said, as far as the pick and roll conversation, I think that's why I'm excited about, you know, these three guys. You know, I would start with, you know, Gary Trent Jr. I think you just look at him as a, you know, a lot has been talked about as far as needing to get younger, needing to have more youth. I mean, Gary Trent Jr. is 25 years old. He's a 40-ish percent three-point shooter. He's a guy in a minimum contract. I'm not sure you could have signed a more impactful guy. You know, I think he probably will be a starter or a finisher or both, you know, for this team. I think you watched him, you know, cook the Milwaukee Bucks, and I think he gave him 31 points on 7 threes this year. And 2 years ago, I think he had 4 games where he had 16 total threes against the Milwaukee Bucks. So he likes the Bucks. Hopefully he can translate it here. I think, you know, to me, you got to have shooting around Damian Giannis. So it's huge. And I think, you know, Torian Prince, obviously, you know, what I think LA last year, he started around like 50 games. He's playing almost 30 minutes a game and another 40% three-point shooter. And so I just see, when you see Prince and then you see DeLon Wright, another good three-point shooter, a long defender, I just see depth and flexibility for Coach Rivers to put different guys around him and see who's playing well. And then obviously find the chemistry in not all of them, but some of them together and figure out who those starters might be, who those depth pieces might be. Because I think they replace guys like, you know, the Wes Matthews and the Jay Crowders from past years. And I think they clearly targeted a certain kind of player. and John Horst. I think he got some of his guys.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the numbers, Steve. Gary Trent Jr. last year, 39% on 6.5 attempts a game. Torian Prince, almost 40% on almost 5 attempts per game. And then DeLon Wright, 37% on, didn't have a high volume. But these guys have shown, especially DeLon and Torian, but they're two-way guys. You know, not just great defensive perimeter players, but when you can package those two, that 3-and-D, that 3-point shooter with a good defensive player, man, you got something special there. And fixing things on the margins, I think, is all the Bucks needed to do. And then your opinion on just how the Bucks, I think, were picked fourth or fifth in the Eastern Conference. I forget Philly, Boston, Philly, New York, Indiana, and then the Bucks, I believe.
What's up with that?
But that's not necessarily a bad thing, though, right? I mean, how do you feel about that, Steve?
No, I agree with you. I don't think it's a bad thing. And I think if you just kind of look, on the surface level of these rankings, I think you look at what teams did last year and you go, the Bucks lost to Indiana and those other teams are doing exciting things, and so fine. And I'll be honest, and Marcus, you know this probably better than anybody, expectation, it can be paralyzing, and it can be something that works against you from your own fans to in the locker room to just around the league. And so it's kind of nice to have lower expectation, because if you look back the last couple of years, the Bucks, they lost not because they weren't good enough. Let's just be honest. When Giannis doesn't play in the last two playoff series, that's the part to me where people go like, the Bucks just aren't who we thought they were. I said, now, it's unfortunate that Giannis has been hurt, but let's also state the fact that if you pull the best player, especially as dominant as Giannis is, off of any of those teams, we're talking about the same exact thing. So obviously, I think the rankings are appropriate if the same things happen this year, where if we're a little old, if we're not as healthy, if we're banged up, and if Giannis isn't there at the end of the season. But I'll be honest, if Chris Middleton, Brooke Lopez, Dame, Giannis are healthy, I'm just telling you now, this is a championship team. That's my very biased opinion. But I say that to be in my very honest opinion as well. So we shall see.
That's the beauty of it. You got to get it done on the floor, man. But look, man, we thank you so much for stopping by, spending some time with us, man. Just great. And quickly, the Knicks championship. I meant to ask you, where did that come from? What's that about?
Oh man, that's my Wisconsin love. So a quick story. I'm playing for the Knicks. Our security guard keeps saying, "You're a Packer fan." I said, "Damn right, I'm a Packer fan. I roll with Don Majkowski. I roll with Brett Favre. Wow. My guy here,
the Magic Man.
And I said, I'm watching him every weekend. When I'm winning bets against guys, I'm making them wear their Packer T-shirts on the plane. And he said, "You love Rodgers so much. Why don't you do the belt when you hit a three, like when he throws a touchdown?" And I said, "That's ridiculous. I would never do something so absurd." Except one Sunday afternoon against the Dallas Mavericks. You know, it's a Sunday matinee. Marcus, you know how this feels.
Yeah.
Playing against the team that cut you last year. They cut me. They signed Peja Stojakovic. They went on to win the championship. I didn't get a ring. I didn't get a check. I didn't get a damn thing. And I felt real in my feelings about playing them the next time.
Facts.
I got hot. I started making threes on Jet. Over Jason Kidd, over everybody on, and I said, "Oh, I don't know what's about." And I did the belt on a Sunday afternoon
in the garden.
I couldn't stop after that. I said, "That's it. I'm doing the belt."
And the fans went just bonkers when you did it. I mean, there was a immediate reaction to that was palpable, that you could feel.
There was. It was one of those things where I did it for me the first time.
Yeah.
But every time after that was for the fans. That was for, I said, "All right, y'all want me to do the belt. I'll keep doing the belt."
Well, now you represented the belt. Well, Aaron Rodgers is proud of you. I wouldn't say would be proud, but he is proud of you, man. And just amazing the impact that you've had on the game. As I mentioned, one of the top 3-point percentage shooters in the history of the game, but the tallest player on that top 10 list, which is an outstanding achievement, man. And just thank you so much for stopping by. Continue the great work that you're doing on the Bucks broadcast. And I agree with you. I think this team is going to surprise some people, but you got to get it done on the floor, and you got to stay healthy, and that's the main thing. So, Steve, have a great afternoon, man. We appreciate you stopping by and checking us out here in the Here District. Come back, will you?
I'll be back. Appreciate you guys. Marcus, you know you're my mentor. I appreciate being on with you. And Chris, always good to see you.
Yes, sir.
All right. Steve Novak, Here District. Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson, the captain of this voyage, vessel, whatever it is. Fantastic voyage. Is that what we say, Chris?
Yes, sir.
That's it. All right. Here, District, we're out of here.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.